This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia. Notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental
or additional to the main topic
in the margin of a book.
As the legend of Wild Bill Hickok still grows, so do the myths, says author Tom Clavin, which is why he set out to separate fact from fiction in his new book, Wild Bill, The True Story of the American Frontier's First Gunfighter. I recently spoke with Clavin about what he discovered. I'm Beth Golay, this is Marginalia, and here's our conversation. There are a couple of things that I wanted to ask about Hickok, specifically about his name. It wasn't Bill or William or Wilfred. What was it?
His name was James Butler Hickok, and his family was originally several generations of New Englanders, and his father, William Hickok, was the one that sort of branched out and moved to Illinois with his wife, and I can't remember if they had maybe one or two children at that time. And they had a baby named Lorenzo, and Lorenzo was still an infant when he died. When their next baby, a male, was born, they named that baby Lorenzo. And so as not to confuse the live Lorenzo with the dead Lorenzo, they called him Bill. Okay. So bear with me on this one. And then some years later, when Lorenzo and his younger brother James, or Jim, were venturing to the West looking for a new homestead for the Hickok family, they were on a steamship together, and they kept calling each other Bill for some reason. They thought it was a joke. They thought it would be funny. When Lorenzo got off the steamship, the people who remained on the steamship continued to call James Butler Hickok Bill, and the name stuck, and he just got so used to it that he just went around as Bill Hickok, later to be known as Wild Bill Hickok when a certain event took place that gave him that name.
That is funny. And so I also wanted to talk a little bit about the last name. It's spelled H-I-C-K-O-K. But in the first chapter, on the first pages, looking back through his lineage, there were six different spellings of that name. And the one that made me sit up at attention, you mentioned that he had New England roots, but they also had English roots. It was his family that farmed 107 acres owned by William Shakespeare. Is that right?
That is correct. And when I found that out, it was kind of exciting to me. But first of all, I'm a research nerd, so finding things out is exciting to me in the first place. But when I was approaching the Wild Bill Hickok story, I really in a lot of ways saw him as almost like a Shakespearean figure, a tragic figure in some ways, even though he led an exciting life and there's a lot of great things about it. But he was somebody who ascended to great heights of celebrity, of people regarding him, respect. But he also fell from that height and kind of a tragic end to his life. And when I found out doing the research, generations back to where the Hickok family that immigrated from England to the United States and saw that there was an actual true connection to William Shakespeare, that his family at least land and farmed on Shakespeare property, I said, well, that's sort of like kismet. There is definitely a connection there, and that sort of fits. But it's true, as the Hickok family, the generations went on, the spellings changed a little bit. A letter was dropped here, a letter was added here. Once they got settled in New England, it pretty much was Hickok and stayed that way, that spelling you mentioned, H-I-C-K-O-K.
Now, the subtitle of the book is The True Story of the American Frontier's First Gunfighter. And it seemed like there were a lot of frontier myths and legends that just aren't true. What were some of the wrongs that you were aware of that you wanted to make right?
Well, Wild Bill Hickok has sometimes been portrayed in television shows and in movies as a bad guy because he was maybe an indiscriminate killer. Gunfighter was not necessarily a compliment. It was equivalent to what they called them back in the day, a man killer. And so I wanted to show that one truth about Wild Bill Hickok is that he was not somebody who would shoot first and ask questions later. In fact, he rarely, during his lifetime, was involved in shootouts. And when he did, it was only because he had no other choice. He always tried to calm the situation down, to say, let's talk. There's a story where he walks into a remote saloon one December day, and he just wanted a drink and get warmed up a little bit and then get back on his way. And basically, these four guys jumped him, and he had to resort to his guns. They had to defend himself, but that was the exception, not the rule. Even with the story that opens the book and sort of explains why Hickok was considered the first gunfighter in the American frontier, he was pushed into that. There was somebody who stole his watch, who was walking around the town square with it in Springfield, Missouri, who wanted everybody to see, I stole Hickok's watch, and he can't do anything about it. And even then, Hickok was trying to buy it back from him. you know, let's not take this any further. And the man absolutely refused and forced a gunfight to take place. So that was definitely one of the myths, that Hickok was not an indiscriminate killer of men. He was somebody who did not want to resort to violence and only would when there was no other choice necessary. Another obvious myth is that, you know, it's been portrayed of the great romance between Wild Bill Hickok and Calamity Jane. And to me, one of the really fun parts about the book is that, first of all, yes, they knew each other, but there was no romance. Second of all, to reveal to the reading public who was the real love of Hickok's life, Agnes Lake. Nobody's ever heard of Agnes Lake. She was the only woman that Hickok marries. She was the only woman that he truly loved to the point where he would marry her. And who was she? She was the only female circus owner. She was a circus impresario on the level of Barnum and Bailey and about a dozen other circuses that would travel the country at that time. She was a well-known equestrian. Her daughter became an international star as an equestrian. And she was the one that Hickok loved and married. And so right there is a couple of myths that I found really enjoyable to write. Okay, here's what the true story is about Bill Hickok.
You know, I found that story very fascinating because their paths would continue to cross. But when they did finally marry, he was 39 and she was approaching 49 or something like that.
Yes.
And it was very short-lived because he came to the end of his life, didn't he?
He did. Agnes was 11 years older than him, and nothing that I read made it seem like that was a barrier to either one of them. And again, with Agnes, she was a strong, independent person in a male-dominated business. And so I'd like to think, you know, my book Wild Bill is not for a male-only audience. I would like people of all genders to find out more about Agnes Lake and what an example she was. But yes, unfortunately, their paths crossed. The time just wasn't right for them to make a commitment to each other. And when it finally was, it was when then she was 49 and he was about to turn 39 when they got married. And because of his needing to make some money on the planes to support them, basically she said, I'll wait here in Cincinnati where she had grown up, and you do what you have to do, and then I'll either go out there and join you, or you're going to come back to Cincinnati having made a good piece of money, and then we'll live happily ever after. And unfortunately, what got in the way was he went to Deadwood, South Dakota, where he met his demise.
And by whom is he buried?
By Calamity Jane. I'm sure he's still spinning in his grave over that, because he did meet Calamity Jane in the summer of 1876, and he didn't really care for her at all. He didn't really care for a woman who could out-curse and out-drink any man. And he found her kind of coarse and really too much of a handful for him. And he was newly married, so he wasn't on the prowl anyway. But when he died, he was buried in Deadwood. And then years later, 1903, was when Calamity Jane died. And there's a couple of different versions how she ended up being buried next to Wild Bill Hickok. One was that some of the guys who were in charge of the burial did it as a joke. You know, let's play this last practical joke on Wild Bill, who liked practical jokes. Or it was a Calamity Jane last request that the people who knew her in her final illness felt they had to honor. So if anybody goes out to Deadwood, South Dakota, you know, tomorrow, they will find the Calamity Jane and Wild Bill Hickok buried side by side in the cemetery.
Now, I found a lot of the Kansas connections really interesting. Is it true that Hickok's family had a role in the Underground Railroad?
It's true. When they had their farm in Illinois, William Hickok, Wild Bill's father, was an ardent abolitionist, and he and his family were anti-slavery. They thought slavery was a terrible thing. And so they used the farm as a way station on the Underground Railroad. So, you know, escaped slaves, smuggled slaves would be hidden out there in the barn in the basement until William could arrange transportation for them to the next station on the Underground Railroad. And sometimes he had to bring them himself. He would load a few of them in a wagon, put a tarp or some hay over them, put William and maybe one or two of his other sons in the seat next to him to avoid the bounty hunters and other lawmen who were out looking for escaped slaves. And sometimes they still got shot at anyway, and they had to escape with these slaves bouncing around in the back of the wagon and his sons exposed to gunfire. So it was pretty exciting. And when Hickok came to Kansas, that was during the 1850s, right in the middle of events that would eventually lead to the term Bloody Kansas being coined, because there was quite a separation between those, many of them coming over from Missouri, who wanted Kansas to be a pro-slave state, and the others in Kansas, some of whom, like Hickok, came from New England or from points north, wanted Kansas to be a state free of slavery when it joined the Union. And as many Kansans know, you know, that led to a lot of violence, you know, civilian armies clashing in battles with each other and all kinds of guerrilla warfare. One of the worst atrocities of the Civil War was the burning of Lawrence, Kansas.
When the Civil War did come about and Hickok enlisted, he was like the only one in his family who was able to enlist, if I remember right. Is it well known the role he played in the Civil War?
I think that's going to be a surprise to people that Hickok, he did join the Union, which makes sense, being an anti-slavery person, when the war broke out. And initially he served as a sharpshooter and scout for Union Army detachments. But then he became a spy, and he spent a good part of the Civil War behind Confederate lines, sometimes even dressed as Confederate, you know, sergeants, officers, to get information and sneak that information back across the lines to Union officers. And there were a couple of close scrapes. There was even one time where he was discovered and put into a cabin so that he could be executed the next morning and thankfully escaped, or this would have been a very short book. There's information about some of his exploits, you know, eyewitness accounts that I could put into the book, but there's a lot we don't know about his exploits. I mean, let's face it, he was gone for sometimes months at a time behind enemy lines. There was no newspaper accounts of his activities. He didn't keep a journal or a diary. There's one, and this is an example of how, you know, I had to be careful of what's been written about Hickok, because there's one biography of Hickok that came out decades ago that actually sold well and got a lot of attention, in which the author quotes from the diary that Hickok kept during the Civil War. There's no such diary. There was no such document. There was no such notebook. A lot of what he did, understandably, will never see the light of day, because we don't know for sure what he did, but we do know that he was behind enemy lines, and he would show up from time to time with information that was very valuable to the Union Army.
Another thing that he did after the war, he served as marshal in Abilene, right?
Yes.
Was it Hays City?
Or? Hays City. Yes, he was sort of like the unofficial marshal, because there were so many legal issues going on there with Hays City that they basically, you know, the governor wouldn't approve him being named marshal, so the city council basically just ignored the governor and say, here's a badge, here's a salary, you know, do what we need you to do, which is what he did in Hays City. And then after that experience, he was hired in Abilene, and Abilene was having a really tough time with law enforcement. It was, when I say typical cowtown, you know, many people in Kansas will know what that means. It was booming as the railroad and the cattle drives to the north intersected in Abilene. But the bad news is there was a lot of lawlessness and very little of a justice system and a jail that was very porous. People came in one door and went out the back door. So Hickok was hired, and he became the prototype for the post-Civil War frontier lawman, which was you had to carry guns, you had to carry weapons, and you had to be ready to use them. You know, the ironic thing about his tenure in Abilene is just that year that he was the marshal in Abilene, you could see the West changing, the evolution, because he came in as a two-fisted, two-gun lawman. And then when he left the job, basically the job left him, because he'd been successful. He had sort of tamed the town. The crime rate was down. People were in jail who were supposed to be in jail. And the city councils realized, you know what, we don't need somebody like Wild Bill Hickok anymore. What we need are peace officers. We need a police department, you know, not just a lone marshal who's going to, you know, enforce the law with his guns. And so just in that year in Abilene, it really is a pivotal experience, I think, on the American frontier, that we started to see the frontier changing. People wanted more civilized, more peaceful societies, and that didn't leave room for somebody like Wild Bill Hickok.
You know, Hickok's skill as a quick draw served him well, especially when he was serving in a role as law enforcement. But It also proved to be dangerous, didn't it?
Well, he had a bullseye on his back. There's no doubt about it, because he was in gunfights. He prevailed. I mean, when he died, he was the undisputed and undefeated, you know, heavyweight champion of gunfighters. Nobody who faced him, you know, ever beat him. So he had a bullseye. He had a reputation that would spread across the American frontier. And the downside of that, of course, is you're going to have somebody who's younger, who thinks he's faster, who's going to take a shortcut to becoming the new heavyweight champion, and that is kill the old heavyweight champion. So he had to always be prepared. You know, when he walked down the street, like when he was the marshal of Abilene, he didn't walk on the sidewalks because he was too worried that he could walk in front of a window or an alleyway or a doorway and somebody's waiting there with a shotgun or a rifle. He always walked down the middle of the street. And he carried his Colt pistols in their holsters with the handles out. He carried one or two derringers. He had a Bowie knife stuck in his belt, and he carried a shotgun. So he had to be ready for something at any time. And You know, there's an example in the book of just that scenario that also shows Hickok's sense of humor. He was a funny guy. And that was when he rounded a corner and suddenly a man named Sullivan is standing there with a gun pointed at him. And he says, "I've got you now, Hickok. I'm going to kill you." And people started to gather around. And Sullivan realized he had the spotlight on him. And he started to explain how he was going to kill Hickok, why he was going to kill Hickok, what the headlines would be, how he'd be celebrated as the new and fastest gunfighter in the American frontier. And he got a little bit distracted, and Hickok was able to, you know, quickly take his gun and fire and shoot him. And after the smoke cleared, Hickok turned to the crowd and said, "He talked himself to death." So he had to be prepared at all times for any eventuality.
You know, the unreliable nature of legends seems to play a huge role in this narrative. You mentioned that an autobiography written by Buffalo Bill Cody had the incorrect date of birth in the very first sentence. And, you know, there was the whole bear story of, you know, how did Wild Bill Hickok really, did he really fight the bear? How did he, you know, he came in contact with a cinnamon grizzly bear. How did you go about finding the truth?
Well, in the case of the bear story, I'm glad you brought that up. I don't know the truth, and nobody knows the truth. You have to go by circumstantial evidence in that, I mean, Hickok said that he fought, encountered this bear, he shot it, he didn't kill it, the bear attacked him, and he eventually killed the bear with his knife. And he was severely, severely wounded in the process of that fight. That's not an unrealistic story, necessarily. And he maintained it was true, and he was not known as a liar. He was a raconteur. He could exaggerate a bit. But also, there is other information that he took a job a couple of months later working for an express stagecoach company. And he worked at this particular place. The job he was given was light manual labor because he's recovering from a number of serious injuries, including, for a while, an almost useless left arm. And Hickok said, you know, the bear had my left arm in its mouth, and if I didn't kill it, it would have bitten it right off. So I tend to think it happened, but the bear didn't live to testify and did not write a memoir. That the bear's not going to help us there, and there was nobody else around. So that's where you sort of like say to your reader, here's what we do know, and here's what probably happened, but, you know, I'm not going to guarantee it for you. There are stories about Hickok killing hundreds of men, obviously not true. The Calamity Jane story is easy to prove true because ultimately Calamity Jane was the only one who would testify that she had this romance with Wild Bill Hickok. There were others who did write accounts of knowing the two of them at the time and saying that was not true at all. So I always compare the research to being kind of like a gold prospector by the side of a river. And, you know, you spend hours dealing there and you're digging in sand and sediment and you're sifting and sifting and sifting. And, you know, at the end of the day, if you're lucky, you have a handful of gold dust. And the days add up to weeks, and the weeks add up to months, and finally, you know, at the end of a year, sometimes it takes 2 years, whatever it takes, you've got enough gold there to write a book. And during the way, of course, a lot of what you've sifted gets thrown out because it's just no good.
You know, I was surprised to learn about Hickok's short-lived career as a performer. Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's a strange story. Certainly Hickok eventually found it very strange. And another thing that people might not know about Wild Bill Hickok is he was, for a time, a successful stage actor, which included being on the New York stage. Buffalo Bill Cody and he were very good friends throughout Hickok's life. And one day, Cody, who had this interest in performing, presented Hickok with a play called Scouts of the Plains, and said, "This is going to make a lot of money, and it's going to be me, you, a guy named Texas Jack, a couple others, a couple of Indians to run around, and basically our play is going to be, we're going to be on stage talking about reminiscing and sometimes reenacting some of our adventures on the plains that we had together and separately." And Hickok at first thought this was, you know, kind of silly, but basically said, "You mean you just meant me, Bill Hickok, to play Bill Hickok?" And Cody said, "Exactly." So Hickok said, okay, especially when he found out he was going to make $100 a week, which was, you know, in those days was good money and certainly a lot more than he was making as a lawman or as a gambler. So he agreed to do it, and they took the play to a couple of out-of-town tryouts, which were successful. They opened in New York City. It was a huge hit. You know, the people were agog, you know, let's buy a ticket and run to the theater where we could actually see these frontier legends, Buffalo Bill Cody and Wild Bill Hickok, do plays about their adventures on the plains. What's not to like? And it was very, very successful. And Hickok became a celebrity in New York. He was the toast of New York. He he would wear his Prince Albert coat out with his cane, and he'd walk down the street between his hotel and the theater, and people would greet him and salute him. He was a celebrity. Eventually, though, it started to wear on him. He just thought it was kind of a stupid way to make a living, which was to recite these terrible lines and to play himself, and he got more and more fed up with it. And the night finally came where he couldn't take it anymore. He took out his gun, he shot out the spotlights and left the theater, and that was it.
Did you discover anything during your research that even lifelong Kansans would be surprised to learn?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question, because to answer that, I think in any way, is kind of presumptuous on my part, because I certainly don't want to think I'm smarter than any lifelong Kansans, that's for sure. I think maybe how much time Wild Bill spent living in Kansas. I think there's probably an understandable picture of Wild Bill as somebody who was out, you know, when they say American frontier, he was in Colorado, he was in Arizona, he was in Wyoming, he was in the Dakotas and New Mexico, and he did at some point be in all of those places. But Kansas became his home. He enjoyed being in Kansas City. I mean, maybe lifelong Kansans would not know how much Wild Bill liked baseball and that he was a fan of the Kansas City Antelopes in the 1860s and, in fact, umpired a game. They allowed him to wear his guns because there had been too much violence at the games. He was a two-gun umpire. So he called Abilene home for a time, Hayes City home, Kansas home. Kansas became the place that he always seemed to return to until he went out west for the last time. So I think that would be kind of interesting for Kansas to know that he loved Kansas. I wouldn't have been surprised that if he had lived and he had gone back to Cincinnati and collected his wife, if they had made Kansas his permanent home.
Now, we've talked about a lot. Any final thoughts that I did not touch on that you would really like the listeners to know?
I think it'd be interesting, you know, to know about Wild Bill Hickok, that he was a bit of a dandy. He took a bath every day. Now, we might take that for granted, but that was unusual on the frontier, where people went for days, weeks, sometimes months without taking a bath. He dressed in a very distinctive way, with the buckskin and the yellow moccasins, his long brown hair, a black sombrero, a vest, as I mentioned, the Prince Albert frock, a coat. And he liked to present himself well. In his later years, he did carry a cane. He embraced celebrity. He didn't look for it, but when it came to him, he sort of embraced it, and he liked the attention of people. He liked talking to people, but it was a real contradiction because he did know there was also the bullseye on his back. You'd think he'd want to lay low a little more, but no, he said, I'm Wild Bill Hickok. Here I am. If you want a piece of me, come and get me. And people tried, but they were not successful.
Well, Tom Clavin, the book is Wild Bill, the true story of the American frontier's first gunfighter. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. I'm happy with this book. I hope readers will be too.
That was Tom Clavin, author of the book Wild Bill, the true story of the American frontier's first gunfighter, which was published by St. Martin's Press. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. You can discover more episodes at KMUW.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Marginalia is produced at KMUW Wichita. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens, Haley Krausen, and Tom Schein. And I am the producer. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.